Okay, this is Bio 241, and it's March 3rd, and it's Tuesday. And we're going to have exam number 2 a week from today. And it's going to cover just 3 chapters. The syllabus has 4, but we'll have the test chapter 9 on the next test, not the one coming up next week. All right, it's a test afterward. So 4, 5, and 7, which is what, enzymes? That's an easy chapter. 5, respiration, a little bit harder, a little bit more involved. And then chapter 7 is like a mega chapter. And so we're not quite done with that, but we'll be done with that one today. Okay, yeah, question. Okay. Myelinated axons are myelinated by 2 different kinds of cells. In the central nervous system, it's oligodendrocyte. And you should maybe have a picture in your mind what an oligodendrocyte looks like. It has many processes. It can myelinate one axon in a number of locations, or it can myelinate a number of axons because of all those different processes. A Schwann cell, on the other hand, is in the central nervous system only. And it's just a simple cell that wraps itself around an axon. Okay, and the other thing you should know is what's the function of those myelin sheets wrapped around an axon. What does it do? It speeds up the rate of impulse conduction. What is a nerve impulse? How would you define a nerve impulse? It's an action potential that's in motion, that's moving down an axon, right? Okay, why can't a nerve impulse go backwards? Why can't an impulse go backwards? Yeah, because of the absolute refractory period, right? Those because there's an inactivation gate that closes, and so once a part of a membrane of an axon depolarizes, it can't depolarize again until it goes over. It is released from that absolute refractory period, so that just allows nerve transmission to go in one direction, not 2 directions. Okay. So does that answer your question? I think so. Yeah, the 2 parts and the oligodendrocyte versus Schwann cells. All right, we're talking about synapses. What's a good way to think of a synapse once again? What is it? A synapse is, you got to have a big picture before you learn the details. The big picture is, it's a structural and functional unit of something. Of what? Not necessarily a neuron. A neuron is a sort of like the structural and functional unit of the nervous system, but what does a synapse allow neurons to do? To communicate with each other. So it's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. And not only neurons have synapses, but other cells have synapses too if they're going to communicate with each other. So what are the 2 kinds of synapses, generally speaking? The most 2 general kinds. You got chemical and electrical. Chemical and electrical. What's the most common kind? Chemical is the most common kind, so there is a chemical signal that goes from one neuron to another, or from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. Generally speaking, what do we call those signaling molecules? Those are neurotransmitters. Give me an example of one neurotransmitter. Acetylcholine is a really good example. We're going to spend a lot more time looking at neurotransmitters today. All right, so last time, let me turn the slideshow on. Last time we talked about this synapse right here. Where's the slideshow? Here. So here is a picture of the old synapse. So that's the structural and functional unit of what? Communication between cells is the synapse. And we saw when an action potential comes down and flows over this axon terminus, it opens up these voltage-gated channels. So in particular, for what ion? Calcium. Yeah, so we don't have voltage-gated channels for calcium anywhere along the axon except at this axon terminus. All right, and don't forget sodium. Why does calcium enter the cell? Because it's going down its electrochemical gradient. It flows into the cell, then it's picked up by a control molecule we call calmodulin, And when calmodulin binds calcium, that activates a protein kinase. And what does a protein kinase do? It runs around. What does it run around? It phosphorylates something. It phosphorylates regulatory proteins, which then allows for the fusion and docking and release of neurotransmitter from these synaptic vesicles that contain neurotransmitter. Okay, and then that neurotransmitter binds to ligand-gated channels in dendrites and cell bodies of the postsynaptic membrane, causing an electrical signal to start up in the postsynaptic cell. So signals go across the synapse, all right, or through a synapse, first as an electrical signal in the presynaptic neuron, as what kind of signal through the synaptic cleft? A chemical signal, and that chemical signal restarts what other kind of signal in the postsynaptic neuron? Another electrical signal. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical through the synapse. All right, so you should be able to follow that. All right, the other thing that this illustration shows you is something about that signaling molecule that enters the axon terminal. And it binds to calmodulin and causes release of neurotransmitter. What is that signaling molecule that enters and binds to calmodulin? That's calcium, right? Where else do you know calcium is important in your body? Yeah, it makes bones strong, right? But as we get older, right, our bones have a tendency to demineralize and disappear. All right, so your body has to come up with a strategy, right? So you need calcium for strong bones, but you also need it for what else in your body? Okay, muscle movement, we didn't talk about that yet in this class, but this is true. You need it for muscle contraction. But what else do you need calcium for? For communication between cells, right? For what we call synaptic transmission. So what do you think is more important for you? To have proper calcium levels so that neurons can communicate with each other? Or is it to have strong bones? If you were going to pick one or the other, what would you much rather have? Communication between cells, right? And of course your body realizes that too, because you couldn't stay alive, right? You can stay alive with weak bones, but without synaptic transmission you would have no chance. So that's one of the reasons why we sacrifice our bones as we get older, to maintain synaptic transmission, right? That's really, really important. Okay, we talked about EPSPs and IPSPs. So different ligand-gated channels can produce an excitatory stimulus, or they can produce an inhibitory stimulus. So what kind of channel is going to open up if it's an excitatory stimulus? So EPSP is going to open up, is the result of opening up what kind of channel? A sodium channel, because that's going to cause depolarization. That's going to bring the membrane potential closer to threshold. And an IPSP is produced by what kind of channel, for instance? For instance, it's going to be produced by maybe a chlorine channel, which hyperpolarizes the membrane, or maybe it's even going to open up a potassium channel. And when potassium leaves the cell, that hyperpolarizes the membrane as well, taking it farther away from threshold or inhibitory. All right, so I think this is where we were when we left off. So make sure, this I don't believe is an exam figure, but you should pretty much know this flow chart right here on synaptic transmission. So first you have an action potential being conducted down an axon. When it gets to the axon terminus, that change in membrane voltage opens up calcium channels, because those are just voltage-gated calcium channels. And calcium then binds to something. What does calcium bind to? Yeah, calmodulin, that's a regulatory molecule, which then activates kinase enzymes that phosphorylate other kinds of proteins that activate them, which then causes release of neurotransmitter. All right, so how does that neurotransmitter get to the postsynaptic neuron? Okay, but how does it move? How does it move? How does it move across this? What is this space right here called? That's the synaptic cleft. How does that neurotransmitter move across the synaptic cleft? Okay, that neurotransmitter moves across the synaptic cleft by what kind of process? Exocytosis is the process of fusing of the vesicles in the axon terminus to the presynaptic membrane, and then the release of neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. But how does it get across the synaptic cleft? Through the postsynaptic membrane or postsynaptic cell. How do these molecules move? Do they have like a little flagellum on there or cilia, or how do they move over there? Okay. Or is there like a little fan in here blowing them around? No, they just move by diffusion. Okay, just by diffusion. So how does a molecule move by diffusion? From high concentration to low, right? So those neurotransmitters are high at the presynaptic membrane, and then they just move down their concentration gradient to the postsynaptic membrane right here. That's how they get there. All right, and then that neurotransmitter will bind to a receptor channel. So how would you explain the nature, the relationship between the neurotransmitter, which is what we call a ligand, and the receptor on the postsynaptic membrane? How would you describe their relationship? Yeah, it's by shape. That's how we understand binding. The shape has to be complementary. So the receptor molecule has to have an active site that's complementary to the shape of the ligand. And so anything that has the shape of that, the proper shape of that ligand, will bind to that particular receptor. All right, and then it's either going to cause a channel to open up. For instance, if it's a sodium channel, it's going to cause an EPSP. Or if it binds and opens up a potassium channel, it's going to produce an IPSP. And these EPSPs and IPSPs are what we call graded potentials. They're not action potentials. So a graded potential is created by a ligand-gated channel. What's responsible for producing an action potential? A voltage-gated channel. So two different kinds of membrane channels. And so these graded, and why do we call these graded potentials? Because, well, first let's go back and think of an action potential. What's the amplitude of action of an action potential compared to the next one or the hundredth one? They're exactly the same, right? So they're not graded. They have constant amplitude. What about graded potentials? They have various degrees of amplitude. Some are very strong, depending on the amount of neurotransmitter released. And furthermore, if instead of an EPSP, if it is an IPSP, what is the amplitude? It's even opposite, right? So it can actually be negative. So graded potentials can cause depolarization to various degrees, and they can even cause hyperpolarization, which is an opposite polarity compared to an EPSP. All right, so these graded potentials converge at one particular place on a neuron, and that is that funnel, right, that is funneling this information into the axon. What is that funnel-shaped structure? That's the axon hillock, and that's where we first see voltage-gated channels. So if graded potentials reach threshold, that's going to trigger an action potential. So sometimes that region on the axon hillock, we call that the trigger zone. So that's an integration area that looks at all the graded potentials, and that neuron then decides whether or not it's going to trigger an action potential. All right, and if it does, all right, and the action potential's got how many main parts to it? Okay, somebody said two. I sort of like that. You could maybe think of maybe some other minor parts like the stimulus and that relative refractory period, but an action potential has got two main parts. The first part is depolarization due to? Yeah, what kind of channel? The sodium channel. So which way does sodium go? Inside the cell. What's the second part called? Repolarization. What's that due to? Potassium channels. So that potassium does what? It leaves the cell, right? So that causes repolarization. All right, that's that action potential, and it moves down the whole length of the axon without decrement, right? Constant amplitude. All right, so let's talk about this neurotransmitter, acetylcholine. All right, so this is kind of a new topic. That's the most widely used neurotransmitter in your body. It's used in the brain. All right, that's part of your central nervous system. It's also used in the autonomic nervous system, which is part of your peripheral nervous system. And it's used at all neuromuscular junctions. So the neuromuscular junction is a synapse So again, it's important for communication between cells. What two cells are going to communicate with each other through the neuromuscular junction?
Neuron.
A neuron. Yeah, what kind of neuron? A motor neuron, right? A motor neuron and a muscle cell, a skeletal muscle cell in particular. So acetylcholine is used in all of these locations right here. So that's why we say it's the most commonly used or widely used. All right, and so there are actually two major kinds of receptor molecules that can bind acetylcholine. And the two major kinds are what we call nicotinic and the other is called muscarinic. So these have active sites that match up pretty close to acetylcholine just by the shape of those molecules. All right, and these different receptor types sometimes are excitatory, sometimes are inhibitory on a cell. So let's just look and see how this goes. So we're talking about what, a ligand-gated channel? Where do we find ligand-gated channels on a neuron? Dendrites and cell body, right? We don't see them along axons. So a ligand, these acetylcholine receptor channels, contain both a neurotransmitter receptor site, which has to obey the lock and key model in order to bind that neurotransmitter, right? It's got to have the right kind of shape. And also an ion channel, which can open and close, open or close, depending on the state of binding a neurotransmitter. Most open when a ligand binds to the channel. This is especially true for a nicotinic kind of receptor. All right, so on the screen right now, I show you a nicotinic type receptor, and we call this a nicotinic type receptor because for a long time we have known that nicotine, which is a chemical produced by plants, has the same kind of shape as acetylcholine and can bind to the receptor of these channels right here. So nicotine acts like what? A neurotransmitter for this particular kind of receptor. All right, so the nicotinic type ligand-gated channel it's a pretty complicated molecule. It has five important polypeptide subunits that form a barrel within the membrane. All right, so it completely spans the membrane, and that barrel can be closed or it can be opened up. And primarily, it works as a sodium channel. So when there is no neurotransmitter bound to this ligand-gated channel, the channel is closed. All right, and even if there's just one acetylcholine binding to this particular channel, the channel is closed, you need to have two acetylcholine molecules bind at two different locations in order to change that conformation to open up. And when it opens up, there is that huge electrochemical gradient that draws sodium inside the cell. Okay, that's the primary effect. Potassium can leave to some degree, but the primary effect is sodium entering the cell. So acetylcholine binds to the receptor site, the channel opens up, sodium enters the cell, and what does that cause? That causes, you could go all the way to the end, that causes excitation, or you could say, well, you know what, it causes depolarization, right, which is what, that drives the membrane toward threshold, so that's an excitatory stimulus. So nicotinic type receptors always cause depolarization. So they are excitatory when acetylcholine binds to this protein right here. And I would guess that this right here is an exam figure. All right, so you should recognize this as a nicotinic kind of receptor channel. So a nicotinic ligand-gated channel produces what kind of stimulus? What are the two kinds of stimuli? They could be depolarization or hyperpolarization, or you could say it produces EPSP or an IPSP. Right? EPSP is depolarization, IPSP is hyperpolarization. So if sodium is entering the cell, what is dominating here? It is an EPSP because it's depolarization. Okay, so these kinds of channels are stimulatory. They're excitatory because they cause depolarization. And these are the kinds of ligand-gated channels that we have at the neuromuscular junction and other locations that we talked about. Okay, another kind of ion channel, receptor ion channel, is that G protein coupled receptor protein that we looked at before, and that was an exam figure for the first exam. The neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel. All right, it's just a receptor protein that's coupled to a G protein. So when a ligand binds to the receptor, that activates the G protein, and then the G proteins can, how many parts does a G protein have? Can you remember? It's got those three parts, alpha, beta, and gamma part. They break away from the receptor protein and they can dissociate, float around on this inner surface of the membrane, and they can bump into channels. And when they bump into a channel, they can open that channel or maybe close a channel. So let's take a look and see what happens here. All right, has anybody ever seen this figure before? That's close. I think I put something like this in Blackboard as on the announcements page. So every time you log into Blackboard, you see something like this. Okay. This kind of channel right here is not a nicotinic type. It's not just a simple receptor channel. It's a G protein coupled mechanism. So in this particular case, you only need one acetylcholine to bind to the receptor molecule, right? As opposed to the nicotinic, you needed two. And do you see a channel right here? No, there's no channel, but this receptor is coupled to the G protein, so here's the G protein. When the ligand, in this case acetylcholine, binds to the receptor, that activates the G protein subunit, and it breaks away from the receptor, floats around in the membrane, and it dissociates into the beta, gamma, or into this alpha subunit. When the beta and gamma bump into this protein right here, right, it's going to cause it to open up. And when, and this is specifically a potassium channel, and when a potassium channel opens up, what's going to happen to the membrane potential of this cell? What happens when a positive charge leaves the cell? Does it hyperpolarize or depolarize? It hyperpolarizes. All right, so this right here is an inhibitory channel on this particular cell. Right, so it inhibits the cell, drives it farther away from threshold. Okay, so this is a good kind of acetylcholine receptor, which is going to what? Inhibit this particular cell. Okay, because of this potassium channel right here. All right, how would you describe the relationship between acetylcholine and the active site on this receptor protein? They have to be, you have to know something about their shape, and their shape has to be what? Complementary. So if this is a big triangular or big columnar active site, would this spherical acetylcholine bind to it? It would not, right? It has to have the proper kind of shape. And this kind of receptor binds also a chemical compound that we find in mushrooms, which is called muscarin. And if you eat the wrong kind of mushroom that has muscarin in it, it will poison all of these receptors, and it's fatal when that happens. Okay? All right, so that's how these receptors got named, because muscarin has a similar shape to acetylcholine that binds this particular receptor right here. All right, even though it's an inhibitory receptor. Okay, well, when acetylcholine is released into the synaptic cleft, it shouldn't work forever. It should have a relatively short life, so that, for instance, if this was acetylcholine working at a neuromuscular junction, if the motor neuron were stimulated one time and released acetylcholine into the neuromuscular junction, and if it never was taken out of the synapse or the neuromuscular junction, what would happen to that muscle? Once you had a signal neurotransmitter causing the muscle to contract, right, if that neurotransmitter never went away, what would happen to that muscle? It would just stay contracted, right? So you couldn't move around, you couldn't breathe. So neurotransmitters have to have a relatively short lifetime so that muscles can relax and then be stimulated again to contract over and over again. So how is it that the activity of a neurotransmitter is attenuated or stopped so that a muscle can relax? Right? And that's because there is an enzyme in the postsynaptic membrane that is called acetylcholinesterase. Acetylcholinesterase. And how can you tell that this is an enzyme right here? Because there's an ASC, and it's going to break down what? You can tell by the name, acetylcholine. So an acetylcholine is released into the synaptic cleft. It can bind to this receptor, or it can even bind to this enzyme, acetylcholinesterase, that breaks it down into acetate and choline. And therefore, these molecules don't have the proper shape to bind to the receptor, and that's going to stop synaptic transmission. All right? So this is just one way to stop the activity of a neurotransmitter, by having an enzyme break it down within the synaptic cleft. That's one way of doing that. And for acetylcholine pathways, that's how it's done, okay, with acetylcholinesterase in this membrane of the postsynaptic cell. All right, let's look at some other neurotransmitters besides acetylcholine. Oh, but you know what, before we do, let's go back and look at where do we find acetylcholine? In the brain, autonomic nervous system, probably you remember that from anatomy, and all neuromuscular junctions. And neuromuscular junctions are the communication between a motor neuron and skeletal muscle, all right? Not between smooth muscle necessarily, all right? So skeletal muscle are the neuromuscular junctions. Okay, so there's that nice nicotinic channel, and here is a muscarinic. All right, other kinds of neurotransmitters. I guess I got to finish up some comments about acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's no sodium is not involved at all. Okay?
They're chloride channels or potassium channels.
But
you might run into one sometime in your lifetime that's a sodium. If it was sodium, what would it produce? Yeah. So I tell you what, let's look at this side and then think about if it was a sodium channel. So here we have a potassium channel that opens up as a result of acetylcholine binding to this receptor. And this potassium channel opens up. Does that produce an EPSP or an IPSP? An IPSP. So is it possible that there you might find a circumstance in some cell someplace that has this G protein coupled receptor where this is a sodium channel that opens up? And the answer is yes, even though it's a muscarinic receptor. You might find channels that are sodium channels, in which case, right, if this is a sodium channel that opens up, what's going to be produced? Is it going to be an EPSP or an IPSP? It's going to be an EPSP because sodium is going to enter the cell. All right, so the cell has that flexibility to do that.
So there's no depolarization before potassium going out.
Yeah.
That's
going to hyperpolarize the membrane or produce what, an IPSP. Yeah.
So and it's not repolarization?
There won't be an action potential there. You'll see where your body uses this kind of channel, in particular the heart. Okay, in a little bit. When we get to the cardiovascular system. So I'm not sure I'm answering your question. Well, okay, so if potassium is leaving, that's hyperpolarizing the cell, right? And then when this channel closes, then that change in membrane potential will go back to RMP, right? So because of the sodium-potassium ATP pumps are going to bring it back to resting membrane potential, and the cell can be stimulated normally after that. But if this potassium channel is open, right, it's going to cause a greater stimulus in order for it to cause an action potential. All right? Or it might inhibit it so much that an action potential can't take place as a result. Okay? Okay. All these systems that use acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter are what we call cholinergic neurons. All right? So all cholinergic neurons use what is a neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine. That's right. So that's what we mean when we say a cholinergic system or cholinergic synapse or cholinergic neuron. It just means that neuron uses acetylcholine. There are very large synapses on skeletal muscle, which we're not going to look at in this chapter, but when we get to muscle, we're going to look at these huge synapses on muscle, and they're called neuromuscular junctions. But it's going to take the same kind of scheme that we looked at before, where an action potential comes down a motor neuron that causes release of neurotransmitter. That neurotransmitter is going to bind to a nicotinic kind of receptor in the neuromuscular junction, which is going to produce a huge EPSP, which is, in every case, going to stimulate that muscle into contraction as a result. Okay. So acetylcholine produces large EPSPs called end plate potentials in skeletal muscle. So we're not talking about synapses between two neurons, but between a motor neuron and a skeletal muscle. And also right in that area on a skeletal muscle, there are going to be voltage-gated channels. We don't see voltage-gated channels in neurons, right, near a synapse, because where do you see voltage-gated channels on a neuron? Not by the synapse, but all the way through the dendrite. The signal has to go through the cell body and find its way into the axon hillock before you find voltage-gated channels. But in skeletal muscle, you have voltage-gated channels even within the neuromuscular junction. So that's where action potentials originate in a skeletal muscle. And so anytime there is an action potential in a motor neuron, that's always going to cause a muscle to contract. So to contrast that with a neuron, right, a neuron can make up its mind whether it's going to trigger an action potential or not at the trigger zone within the axon hillock, depending on how EPSPs and IPSPs summate to reach threshold. But in skeletal muscle, any time there is an action potential at the neuromuscular junction, that's a sufficient stimulus to cause muscle contraction. The skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether or not it's going to contract. When it gets in a signal, it's always going to be an EPSP, and the result is 100% what's going to happen every single time, muscle contraction, right? The skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind, which is a really good thing, because what would happen if I were to be standing here lecturing, and then all of a sudden I wanted to click my mouse to go to the next slide, but my skeletal muscles would say, no, I don't want to do that, okay? Can skeletal muscles ever decide for themselves if they're going to contract or not? No, they're under voluntary control. They will contract to their best ability every time you give them a command to do that. Okay, unlike a neuron can decide depending on what? Many, many kinds of influences. And remember, a neuron, all the synapses on the dendrites and cell bodies, if you were to add them all up, a neuron might have as many as 10,000 synapses, all integrating that information up, and then the neuron can make a decision. But a skeletal muscle never makes a decision. It just follows that order to contract. That's all there's to it. Okay. And there's a chemical compound that can block acetylcholine because it can bind to the binding site of those nicotinic receptors in the neuromuscular junction. All right, so that will block signal or synaptic transmission at the neuromuscular junction. So curare is a poison that will stop muscle contraction, in particular skeletal muscle contraction. All right, so that's pretty dangerous stuff. All right, because if you have curare in your system, what gets blocked? Yeah, synaptic transmission at the neuromuscular junction, namely those nicotinic receptors, and then you no longer have control over your skeletal muscles. So what's a real important skeletal muscle that you use all the time? Your diaphragm for breathing, for instance, right? And so there were Aboriginal peoples in South America that knew where to find curare, and they could paint little darts with curare and use them for hunting, because they could shoot a huge game animal with a little bit of that poison, and after, you know, maybe a minute or so, what would happen to that animal? Couldn't breathe, yeah, it would suffocate, couldn't run away, and then it was just like a fiesta, right, that evening. So that's really a good thing. They didn't need huge, huge arrows and things like that, right? That just had a little poison war tip on a little dart. But you would never let your kids play with such things. Okay. Other kinds of neurotransmitters we call monoamines neurotransmitters, because guess what do they have? They have just a single amino group on them, okay? So these are monoamine neurotransmitters, and you should know the names of some of them. Serotonin is one, norepinephrine and dopamine are monoamine neurotransmitters. So they act a lot like acetylcholine. Serotonin is derived from tryptophan. Norepinephrine and dopamine are derived from tyrosine. We haven't spent a whole lot of time with these right here, but can anybody tell me something about tryptophan or tyrosine? What are these things? These are amino acids. And what do you do with amino acids? Okay, you can make neurotransmitters, these neurotransmitters out of them. But what else can you do with amino acids? You can make proteins out of them, right? All right, so there's a lot of, so this is a building block for a protein, number one. Number two, it's a building block for monoamine neurotransmitters. And there's something else that's interesting about these particular amino acids. These are what we call essential amino acids. All right, so what is an essential amino acid? You can't synthesize these in your body. All right, you need the proper precursors, or you even need these amino acids in your diet. All right, and what's a source for these amino acids? What do you have to eat in order to get them? You have to eat protein, but what kind of protein? It has to be an animal protein, okay? Can't be just a plant protein like rice, for instance. All right, so if your diet isn't proper, guess what your body can't make? It can't make these monoamine neurotransmitters. All right, so diet can influence the production of these neurotransmitters, and all of these neurotransmitters that we're looking at right here are implicated in clinical depression, schizophrenia, etc., etc. So what does that mean? That means that an improper diet can exacerbate these different conditions, right? So that's really kind of a shame, because there's still a huge stigma that people have to deal with if they ever experience clinical depression and schizophrenia. And it might be something as simple as what? Just correcting your diet, right? All right, so I think that's probably a pretty important concept for you guys to be aware of too. All of these systems, all of these neurons that use serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine are what we call catecholamine pathways. Right, so all of these neurotransmitters right here are called catecholamines. So what did we call acetylcholine? A cholinergic. Yeah, cholinergic pathway. These are all catecholamines. Okay. All right, so here is the kind of synapse for catecholamines. All right, so if there is an action potential that comes down the axon terminus, again, there are calcium voltage-gated channels that allows calcium to enter the cell. And so dopamine is produced from tyrosine. It's converted into some various kinds of compounds. And then finally, norepinephrine that's stored in this vesicle right here. When calcium enters the cell, that causes, again, the release of neurotransmitters via what, exocytosis into the synaptic cleft. And then norepinephrine is going to bind to this receptor right here. Now, what does that kind of look like to you? What kind of receptor does that look like? Does that just look like a simple channel protein or what? It looks like it looks like that muscarinic one, right? But this is actually what the G protein coupled receptor. Okay, so this is a G protein coupled receptor. So it's going to activate the G proteins, which then are going to bump into a channel someplace, either closing or opening a particular channel. All right, so now how is norepinephrine, the action of norepinephrine, let me go back and ask this question. How does norepinephrine move from the presynaptic membrane to the postsynaptic membrane? By diffusion, right? Just from high concentration to low concentration. All right, now the activity of norepinephrine is stopped not by an enzyme that's in the synapse like we saw for acetylcholine, but by a different kind of mechanism that we call reuptake. All right, so a lot of this neurotransmitter is actively pumped back into the presynaptic neuron, thereby decreasing its concentration in the synaptic cleft. So we call that reuptake. And once it's taken up by the cell, this is where we find the enzyme that can break it down, and that's what we call monoamine oxidase. All right, so monoamine oxidase will break down norepinephrine into its building blocks, and then the cell can build it back up if it needs to. All right, so this is I think this is important because, for instance, in clinical depression, one of the pathways or two of the pathways that are involved are norepinephrine pathways and serotonin pathways, where there is a deficiency of synaptic transmission. So if we want to enhance synaptic transmission, what would be one way to increase the effects of norepinephrine? Yeah, you can inhibit reuptake, and there are reuptake inhibitors, right? Or you can inhibit monoamine oxidase, and so there are MAO inhibitors, which then potentiate the effects of serotonin and epinephrine, which provides relief for depression. Okay, so MAO inhibitors are used as antidepressants. All right, so that's just a pharmacological basis for treating affective disorders. Okay, so let's look in a little bit more detail what the receptor system looks like for monoamine neurotransmitters. All right, their receptors activate G proteins with a cascade mechanism to affect ion channels. So here is the receptor molecule. Notice that the receptor molecule is not a channel. And how would you describe the relationship between norepinephrine and the receptor right here? The shape has to be complementary, right, of the active site. And when the receptor binds the ligand, that activates the G protein, which causes it to dissociate, remember, either into the beta gamma or the alpha subunit. The alpha subunit is going to now bump into an enzyme that is placed in the membrane. Now, it's still not a channel at this particular time. This is an enzyme called adenylate cyclase, and adenylate cyclase can catalyze the reaction or the conversion of ATP into cyclic AMP. So how many phosphates are in ATP? You got three. How many phosphates are in AMP? One, right? So the two phosphates are cleaved off, and in so doing, it forms a cyclic ring structure, right, which is a special kind of molecule. So cyclic AMP is a special molecule. Is it expensive to make? Yeah, relatively so, because in order to make it, you got to sacrifice an ATP. And remember, through all of glycolysis, how many ATP do you make? Only two, right? So this is an important control molecule that your cells don't synthesize frivolously because it's very expensive, but it's an important control molecule. Because cyclic AMP can take a protein kinase that's inactive and turn it into an active form, and this active form will phosphorylate various proteins, and it might even phosphorylate another protein, which is a membrane channel, in which case this membrane channel opens up and allows some ions to move through. And again, it could be a sodium channel or it could be a potassium channel. If this is a sodium channel that opens up, what's going to happen to this cell? It's going to depolarize, which is what? Excitation, right, that produces an EPSP, or if this is a potassium channel or a chloride channel, it's going to produce an IPSP, inhibiting the cell. So these monoamine neurotransmitters still can cause either one of these things to happen. All right, so what is the beauty of this system right here when we say it is a cascade system? Well, first, I think you should recognize that does norepinephrine ever enter the cell? Okay, it stays outside the cell, can't get through, but it's an important signaling molecule, right? It's sending a message to this cell right here, all right? And what about cyclic AMP? Does it ever leave the cell? No, it is where? Inside. So now the level of cyclic AMP is somehow coupled to what the level of norepinephrine, Right, so norepinephrine is what we call the first messenger. And what do we call cyclic AMP? That's the second messenger as a result of this G-protein coupled reaction right here. Right, so the first messenger is always outside the cell. The second messenger is always inside the cell. And what can you tell me about this adenylate cyclase when it converts one ATP into one cyclic AMP? Does it get used up? What can an enzyme do? It can catalyze that reaction over and over and over and over again, right? It doesn't get used up. The only thing that changes is that substrates get converted into products. All right, so adenylate cyclase, when it becomes activated, when this alpha subunit binds to it, right, it can produce thousands of cyclic AMP molecules inside the cell as the result of binding how many norepinephrine molecules?
One.
Just one. All right, so we're going from one signaling molecule to thousands of cyclic AMP molecules. So that is a level of amplification. So that signal is not only transferred, translocated across the membrane, but as it's being moved across the membrane, being converted from a first messenger to a second messenger, it is also amplified thousands of times. Okay? Now what else is happening? What does that cyclic AMP do? It activates another enzyme, which is going to phosphorylate something. And when protein kinase phosphorylates something, does it go away? Does it get used up? No, it can catalyze that reaction over and over and over again. So when you have cyclic AMP that's been amplified thousands of times from that one initial norepinephrine, right? That cyclic AMP can then create even thousands more protein kinases to become activated. So here is a second step of amplification. All right, so one signaling molecule can make things happen very quickly and profoundly inside the cell because of these different steps of amplification. All right, and when you have different steps of amplification, that's what we call a cascade mechanism. So it allows these channels to change state in a hurry, in a really big way. You don't need thousands of signaling molecules to elicit a very large response inside the cell because of what? This cascade mechanism right here. All right, so I think that's important for you to see on this slide as well. So that's what a cascade does. So cascade mechanism, tell me again in your own words, what does a cascade mechanism do? It amplifies the first messenger and it produces a very fast response inside the cell. Okay? And that happens when you have a G-protein coupled mechanism like this, not when you have just a simple ligand-gated channel like a nicotinic kind of channel that is activated when it binds acetylcholine. Okay? This is thousands of times faster and more potent than just a ligand-gated channel. Now, did I see a question? Yeah. So in this particular case, the second messenger would be cyclic AMP, right? Cyclic AMP. Okay, and how is cyclic AMP produced? What's the name of the enzyme? Yeah, adenylate cyclase. Look at the spelling of it because it's a little bit difficult to pronounce. Adenylate cyclase, right? So adenylate cyclase. That's another name of an enzyme you should be aware of. What's another enzyme? Yeah, acetylcholinesterase is really good. Kinases, phosphatases. What about carbonic anhydrase? What does that catalyze? Yeah, CO2 and carbonic acid. Okay, that's another important one for you to know. What about lipase? Breaks down lipids. Yeah. Question. Yeah. Well, it's always going to dissociate. So this G protein is always going to dissociate from the receptor protein, and it's always going to dissociate into an alpha and the beta gamma, into these two subunits. And these subunits are going to bump into a protein in the membrane, so it could be an alpha subunit or it could be the beta gamma. And that protein could be, as we saw for a muscarinic type receptor, was just a plain old channel that opened up. But in this particular example, this is not a channel that opens up. It is what? An enzyme that actually becomes activated. and starts and initiates that cascade with the two different steps of amplification. Well, I tell you what, it's going to depend on what kind of proteins this particular cell inserts into the membrane, right? And that's going to be controlled by the nucleus. So this particular cell might not put an adenylate cyclase enzyme in the membrane, in which case then this alpha unit right here is not going to respond by producing cyclic AMP. For this one right here? Well, for that muscarinic receptor, it was the beta and gamma subunit that had to bump into it. All right, so I think it relies more on what channel proteins or enzymes are put into the plasma membrane that determines the activity of this G protein right here when it dissociates. Okay, this is just one example. Okay, so we'll probably see some other examples in a little bit. All right, so that's why we started with, on the first test, just knowing something about a G-protein-coupled mechanism, right, without looking at any of the other details. So now we're adding some details to it. All right, so serotonin is involved in the regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, and even cerebral circulation. LSD is structurally similar to serotonin. So guess what LSD likes to do? It likes to bind to serotonin receptors, right? And it might activate them. So serotonin-specific reuptake inhibitors are also used as antidepressants because when somebody has clinical depression or a depressed mood, that is due to decreased activity of serotonergic pathways as well as norepinephrine pathways. All right, Prozac, Zoloft, Paxil, Luvox, these are all that are what specific reuptake inhibitors. So when serotonin is released in the synaptic cleft, that prolongs their activity, and they can bind and release from a receptor molecule and then bind to a receptor once again, thereby potentiating its effects. Exactly right, because for instance, when you use these pharmaceutical agents, what do you have to do? It's not like just flipping a switch. You have to build, what do you have to do? Well, you got to build more serotonin, right? And probably your body, these neurons are going to adjust the levels of these different membrane proteins in the postsynaptic membrane. So there's a lot of protein synthesis that has to take place. And it might be, you know, a week or two before any of these effects will be noticed by the person. Okay. We're at the, LSD? LSD is a hallucinogen, all right? And it was used recreationally back maybe in the 60s, maybe in the 50s, and it produces very severe hallucinations, okay? Because it binds and poisons the serotonin receptors. So LSD is something that produces a hallucination. Sometimes it's called a trip, okay? And when you look at, if you were to look at that column right there, instead of looking like a cement column, it would look like a waterfall or something. Okay, it would have motion and color. So hallucination is produced by a stimulus, but you are what? You're appreciating it in an inappropriate way. Okay, so hallucination is not produced by itself, but you have to experience some kind of stimulus. But your appreciation of that stimulus is completely abnormal, okay? And that's what LSD produces. Lysergic acid, but I forget exactly the chemical name. Yeah, I don't know where that D comes from. All right, it's probably more of an organic designation, okay? I'll look that up. I don't know if I'll be able to remember, but if we have time, we could Google LSD and see what the... And they probably even have a picture of what it looks like in there. All right, so what have we talked about so far? Norepinephrine, serotonin, all right, and the last one is dopamine, all right, is another important neurotransmitter. You could break down the effects of dopamine into two major categories. And even in anatomy, we probably didn't talk much about this, but the nigral striatal dopaminergic system, this is part of the basal nuclei inside the brain. And maybe you did learn about the basal nuclei because they're involved with regulating motor activity, right? Which is what? Initiated by your frontal lobe. Then it goes to the basal ganglia where the movements are coordinated. So substantia nigra is part of the basal nuclei. Degeneration in this area causes Parkinson's disease. All right, so when somebody's... So what the basal nuclei really do is allow you to have nice fluid motion. All right, in order to have fluid motion, there has to be inhibition of antagonistic muscles. Right? So for instance, if I wanted to contract my biceps to flex my forearm in a nice, easy, gentle manner, what do you have to do to the triceps? You have to inhibit the triceps. You have to cause it to relax. Right? Well, when there is degeneration in Parkinson's disease, right, the antagonistic muscles are not relaxed. Right? So in order to flex your forearm, what do you have to do? You have to contract it really hard to stretch the triceps. So your motions are very, very rigid, they're awkward, and even walking, your motions are what? Very rigid and awkward. So if you look at somebody with Parkinson's disease walking, what do they look like? They don't have any motor control, they lose balance very easily, they look like they're intoxicated. Or, intoxicated, drunk, for instance. Okay, but of course you have to be really concerned when you're in a clinical setting that you don't treat somebody like a drug seeker when they have, or an alcoholic when they have Parkinson's disease, because they're not drunk. They just can't move normally as a result of degeneration of this dopaminergic system. Okay, the other one is the mesolimbic dopaminergic system, and this is important in behavior and reward. So when this system gets stimulated, all right, what does a person feel? They feel euphoric as a result of that, all right? And cocaine stimulates this particular system, all right? Binds to receptors. And so when somebody, for instance, takes cocaine, how do they feel? Very, very euphoric. But unfortunately, cocaine only lasts for, nobody in here probably knows, but only minutes, okay? And when cocaine is then depleted from your system, how do you feel? Instead of euphoric, you feel depressed, okay? And you're missing out on life. So what is your next inclination to do? Well, to take more cocaine so you can feel that euphoria again, all right? So that's really actually, you know, a terrible drug because it doesn't necessarily make you feel euphoric, it makes you feel what? Depressed, right? Unless you can support that habit. All right, so most addicts activate this particular system. Overactivity contributes to schizophrenia, schizophrenia can be treated, or the addiction can be treated by anti-dopamine drugs. Okay, norepinephrine, used in both the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. In the peripheral nervous system, it's a sympathetic neurotransmitter. Okay, well, let's talk about the peripheral nervous system a little bit. And one division of the peripheral nervous system, what are the two divisions maybe of the peripheral nervous system that you could think? How would you want to break it down? A number of different ways, and I'm not sure you can read my mind and know what are the two ways. So the autonomic nervous system can be broken down into sympathetic and parasympathetic. What's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic in most cases? They're opposite each other, right? They're antagonistic to each other. And norepinephrine is the sympathetic neurotransmitter, right? So remember, the autonomic nervous system has got two divisions. If norepinephrine is for the sympathetic nervous system, guess what acetylcholine is? That's the neurotransmitter for the parasympathetic nervous system. Okay? All right, so we're going to look at that, especially in the next chapter coming up. In the central nervous system, it affects general level of arousal, all right, or wakefulness. And so amphetamines stimulate those norepinephrine pathways. Okay. I can't remember any good stories about why we don't use amphetamines for treating clinical depression. I've forgotten. Sure, that's going to stimulate these norepinephrine pathways, and that will maintain what? A wakeful state. And people say that when they take amphetamines, they actually enjoy studying. Okay? And diet pills, because these amphetamines also suppress hunger as well. Yeah, so that would be the example of a diet pill. Okay. Okay, but I don't recommend abusing amphetamines just to make studying fun. Okay? You should learn on your own how to make studying fun. Okay? Because chances are you're going to have to learn things for the rest of your life, and it might as well be fun sooner rather than later. Okay, there are some amino acid neurotransmitters. All right, so amino acids, what are amino acids again? They are building blocks of proteins, and remember we saw tryptophan and tyrosine as important for monoamine neurotransmitters, but even other amino acids can be used as neurotransmitters in an unmodified form. These are glutamic acid or glutamate or aspartic acid. Sometimes we call that aspartate. These are major central nervous system excitatory neurotransmitters. So when these bind to a receptor, what do they produce if they are excitatory? They produce depolarization because they're going to open up a sodium channel primarily, right, and drive that neuron up to threshold with a graded potential. Glycine, on the other hand, is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. So how could you maybe describe to me why a particular ligand might produce inhibition? What is it going to open? A chloride channel or a potassium channel? That's going to cause hyperpolarization, right? So glycine is very important. And remember, probably the most important thing you could learn in a class like this is the importance of antagonism for precise control and balance in your body. If all you have are excitatory synapses or excitatory receptors, what's going to happen to your body? Or for instance, you're just going to go into contracture. You can't move, right? So you need to have balance. You need to have inhibition as well as excitation in order to have a balanced body. So we need glutamate, aspartate, as well as glycine, right, to produce that balance in your body. And as a matter of fact, we can selectively poison these chloride channels that are operated with glycine with this chemical called strychnine, right? So strychnine blocks the glycine receptors. And what happens when somebody is poisoned with strychnine, right, if they don't experience any kind of stimulus whatsoever, they might have a fairly normal kind of experience. But as soon as something touches their body or they hear a sound like that, right, all of their skeletal muscles in their body contract, right, and they stay contracted. So then what happens? If all the muscles in your body contract, yeah, you die because you can't breathe as a result of that. All right, so that's what strychnine does. So strychnine is kind of a really nasty poison as a result of that. Gamma-aminobutyric acid is the most common neurotransmitter in the brain, and it is also inhibitory, working by hyperpolarizing neurons because there are chloride channels right there. And these are the neurons that degenerate in Huntington's disease. So you can imagine that Huntington's disease is kind of like a Parkinsonian kind of disease where the predominant effect is what? Muscle contraction, where you can't relax muscles, you don't have fluid movement, and you also lose control of skeletal muscles. Okay. Okay, then we have a last topic, synaptic integration. So we said that neurons act like little integration centers, right? They can make a decision whether they're going to generate an action potential or not. What part of a neuron makes a decision as to whether or not an action potential will be triggered? The axon hillock, right? Or the trigger zone, for instance. All right, so every neuron acts as its own little integration center. All right, so for instance, here we have a postsynaptic neuron, and you can see some axons of a presynaptic neuron right here, and we can see a couple synapses. All right, now these when neurotransmitter is released from the synapse, it's going to bind to a ligand-gated channel and produce a graded potential? What did I miss? Did I miss something? No, okay. Oh, you know what? The sign-in sheet is right here. Yeah, let's pass it around. That's probably really important. Does that say 241 on there someplace? Yeah, good. Okay. Okay, so here you have a bunch of synapses, and what are these synapses good for? That's how cells communicate with each other through the, and these are chemical synapses. All right, and so when neurotransmitter is released, we see something happening to the RMP, resting membrane potential. So what's happening to this resting membrane potential? It is depolarizing, right? And what causes depolarization? These excitatory neurotransmitters produce, and are these EPSPs or IPSPs? These are E because they're driving the membrane potential to threshold. Okay, and that just depends on the amount of neurotransmitter that's released, and that depends on what coming down the axon right here. What's going to directly relate to the amount of neurotransmitter that's released? Yeah, the what? The frequency of action potentials, right? Because every action potential has the same amplitude. You have to put more of them together in the same amount of time to get more neurotransmitter released. Okay, so these are what we call graded potentials. By the time they reach the axon hillock right here, have to reach threshold. And graded potentials have no refractory period, and they do summate at the axon hillock right there. All right, so let's look at two presynaptic neurons and one postsynaptic neuron. And let's look at two different circumstances. The first circumstance, let's just say that there is only one neuron, all right, the first neuron right here, releasing neurotransmitter on the postsynaptic cell, and it's going to be releasing an excitatory neurotransmitter. But what can you tell me about this graded potential right here? How would we talk about this graded potential? It is subthreshold, right? So that by the time it reaches the axon hillock right here, it is not going to produce an action potential. But now let's just say that there is excitation or action potentials coming down both of these neurons, right? So they're causing a number of EPSPs on the postsynaptic neuron, and these EPSPs can summate in the axon hillock right here. So here's one from cell number one, here's EPSP produced by cell number two. They summate at the axon hillock, and now what can you tell me? That is a threshold stimulus, and that's going to trigger an action potential. Here we see an action potential, and where else are you going to see that same action potential? All the way down at the axon terminus, because it gets transmitted all the way down the axon without decrement. Right? So I for sure would be able to draw this action potential, label it like, this is, what is this phase right here? This is depolarization. What's that due to? This is repolarization. What is that due to? And even this little area right over here, this is hyperpolarization. That produces what? A relative refractory period. And what's that due to? Again, it's just the really slow acting potassium channels, right, in the sending part of this neuron right here. All right, so spatial summation takes place when EPSPs from different synapses, maybe from even different neurons, occur at the postsynaptic cell at the same time. Okay, so that's spatial summation. Temporal summation, on the other hand, occurs because EPSPs might be generated closely in time from one source, and they can summate. All right, so maybe we just have one cell right here that is producing two EPSPs, but these, if they're produced at the same time, there is no refractory period. Maybe they're close enough in time to where they can still add together within the axon hillock to meet threshold, and that's going to cause an action potential. That will trigger an action potential in the axon as well. So you have both spatial summation and temporal summation working to trigger an action potential. Okay, and then I think the last concept that we have is not only just EPSPs, but you can also have what? IPSPs produced on the postsynaptic membrane. And so if one cell is inhibitory, like the presynaptic neuron number one, and the presynaptic neuron number two is excitatory, if both of these release excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitter, what's the overall effect going to be? It means that they're going to cancel each other out, so that threshold is not reached, and so the postsynaptic neuron won't trigger an action potential. All right, so even this neuron acts as an integration center. Okay, so presynaptic inhibition occurs when one neuron synapses onto an axon or bouton of another neuron, inhibiting release of neurotransmitter. That's the next slide. So here is an example of presynaptic inhibition. So what do we got? Here is the postsynaptic neuron right here. And how many presynaptic neurons do we see? I see one, two, I see three of them. Okay? And where are the bouton terminales at? Well, I see one here on this dendrite. I see another one sort of on the soma, but it's sort of on the dendrite right at the junction right there. And here's another one that's on the soma and then on the dendrite. Okay, and then I see this third neuron. And where is the synapse of this one going? It's going to the axon, right, of this excitatory neuron. All right, but this one right here is inhibitory. So not only is it going to inhibit the soma, but it's actually going to inhibit this excitatory neuron. It can block the transmission or the propagation of an action potential in this location right here. Because remember, how does an action potential get propagated? What has to happen? There are voltage-gated channels right here that still have to reach threshold. But if this region of the membrane becomes hyperpolarized, okay, then that's going to block action potential propagation through this region right here, and then it's going to prevent the release of neurotransmitter at the synapse as a result. So this is something more recent scientists have become aware of. Okay, but that's not the typical kind of synapse that we've really talked about. The typical one is what? This one right here. Yeah, I think that's an exam figure, too. It's not in your book? Okay. But before we go, yeah, I want to ask you, at this synapse right here, why is it that signals can go from the presynaptic neuron into the postsynaptic neuron, but not from the postsynaptic neuron back into the presynaptic neuron? Why can't it go retrograde across the synapse? Why can't it go retrograde across the synapse? Okay. Well, diffusion just goes from high concentration to low. All right. So if we look at this synapse right here, what is carrying the information across the synapse? It's the neurotransmitter, all right? And what cell has neurotransmitter that it can release? Is it both? Is it both the presynaptic and postsynaptic? Or is it the postsynaptic only or the presynaptic only? It's only the presynaptic neuron that has neurotransmitter that it can release. So synaptic transmission cannot go retrograde because the postsynaptic cell doesn't even have neurotransmitter to release into the synapse so that the signal can go backwards. That's one reason. Maybe another reason? The receptors. Somebody said receptors. I like that a lot. What cell has receptors? Only the postsynaptic neuron. So for instance, if the postsynaptic neuron was able to release a neurotransmitter, the presynaptic neuron couldn't respond to it anyway, because what do you have to have in order to respond to a ligand? You have to have a receptor to it. Okay, so in a typical kind of synapse, only the presynaptic cell has neurotransmitter and only the postsynaptic cell has a receptor, so information flows in one direction. Yeah. They would have to have receptors, like in this last picture that we have right here. Let's go back. Right here, there has to be receptors right here in the presynaptic neuron. Okay.
So the only way they
I'm not sure we really are familiar with how many neurons have those kinds of systems. Probably we will learn more and more and more as the years go on. Okay. Okay, so that's just the basic idea. Okay. Yes. Yeah, that's going to hyperpolarize the membrane right here instead of depolarizing it. That's going to hyperpolarize, yeah, this, in this circle right here, that's going to produce iPSPs in the axon, which is going to inhibit the transmission of an action potential across this location right here. So the action potentials won't reach this axon terminus right here. Yeah. Yeah. Say that again. It will be blocked right here. If it's working, it's going to be blocked. It's going to prevent depolarization. Okay. So Thursday, we're going to go on to the next chapter, which I think is 9. Yeah, we're going to move on to the next chapter. So this class is just a tiny bit ahead of the other ones. Hi.